Counsel in the third case may come forward. I will now call the third case set for oral argument today, and that is case number A22-1579, State of Minnesota versus Ivan Contreras Sanchez. Counsel are familiar with our procedures. Counsel for appellant, you may approach. Please introduce yourself and your client, and then you may begin your argument.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Jennifer Workman. I'm an appellate public defender, and I represent the appellant, Ivan Contreras Sanchez. Your Honors, this case presents a novel question concerning the constitutionality of geofence warrants. The geofence warrant here lacked probable cause, and it was insufficiently particular and overbroad. No court, state or federal, has upheld a geofence warrant under these same circumstances. The district court invented a so-called relaxed standard in order to save this warrant, a standard that has not been adopted by any other court. The language of this warrant allowed the police to seek whatever data they wanted within an almost 19,000 square foot area over a 31-day period. The purpose of the warrant was blatantly exploratory. The application said police would, quote unquote, use the information provided by Google to develop possible suspects or witness to whoever left the victim's body at the location in the culvert. The warrant contained no language that provided probable cause to believe anyone in the geofence boundaries carried a cell phone or that those cell phones would be Google-connected devices. And the warrant violated the specificity requirement because it was not narrowly tailored as to time, location, or scope. Although this is a sad and tragic case, Mr. Contreras' constitutional rights take precedence, and the long-standing principles that underpin the state and federal constitutions compel this court to find that this warrant does not pass muster. Mr. Contreras asks this court to reverse his convictions.
Counsel, in your opening, you focus on this warrant. I assume you're referring to the first warrant that was issued.
Yes, Your Honor. Actually, Your Honor, just to clarify, we have problems with both of the warrants. The first warrant taints the second warrant, but I think most of the argument goes to the first warrant because there's more to say about the step one and the step two process that is contained within the first warrant.
So would you agree that the first warrant covers only step one and step two?
Your Honor, no. The first warrant initially covered all three steps. Then after the police officers decided to get a second warrant after step two came through, then the second warrant covered the step three again. But regardless of whether you're looking at both warrants or just the one, both of them don't pass the constitutional standards. The second warrant is tainted by the first warrant. They could not have gotten the second warrant without the first warrant, and therefore both of them are suspect here.
So the state argues that in looking at, and I agree with you that the first warrant covers all three steps. The application, though, specified that the detective would seek a second warrant for step three. But the first warrant didn't specify that. The
right.
State argues in its brief that the first warrant should be read as limited to steps one and two based on the officer's or detective's application and statement included in that.
I completely disagree with that. And the reason is because that first warrant speaks for itself. That first warrant sought all three steps. That first warrant went through the entire process to get there. And it was only because somebody stepped in and said, hey, maybe you just want to do the second step, is what the second warrant is what led them to that second warrant. Otherwise, they would have been happy to go forward with just one warrant.
So is there a case you can point us to that suggests that we should read the first warrant based in its entirety? I know that the state cites, I think it's the Balduke case, to support its position. I'm not sure how on point that case is, but is there a case you can cite us to support your argument?
Your Honor, just as far as geofence warrant cases are concerned, Chatry, Mesa, several of the Google cases all concern one warrant. They all take into account the step one, step two, step three process. And they,
yes, I'm sorry, I should make my question a little more precise, that we shouldn't consider the affidavit as a limiting factor when reading the warrant.
I can't think of a case off the top of my head, but I think it is a common sense thing when you look at the language of the second warrant, it depends entirely upon the first warrant. And when you have such a non-attenuation there between the language of the warrant, then they depend upon each other. They have to either rise or fall together. And that's where we are here. I think I know of that principle in the law. I just can't cite to you a case at this point.
Thank you.
Chatry doesn't really help you that much, does it?
Chatry is very helpful, Your Honor, but the point in Chatry that sort of hangs up is different here is that Chatry applies a different harmless error than we have in Minnesota.
Well, but they lay out a procedure for that they think would be acceptable, and it seems like it was followed here because the principle is that in that case there was no judicial review, but here there was at each step.
There's not a judicial review at each step, especially when you look at that first warrant. It gives way too much discretion to the police officer to determine how much time they want, how much data they want. It gives too much discretion to them to go back and forth and collaborate with Google to determine what they want to take. And that happened here. Google said to them, you know what, 31 days is too long. Could you shorten this up? And without going back to a judicial oversight, they went and shortened their warrant time. And that shows that this was overbroad. It shows that they had too much discretion within the language of the warrant itself.
But that doesn't identify anyone, does it? It only identifies the data, right?
So I think you're getting to the anonymous nature of
right.
This. The anonymous data does not save this warrant. When you go back and look, we always have to start with, was there probable cause laid out in the language of the warrant itself, and was the language sufficiently particular? When you go back and look at that warrant, there is not language in there to believe that there is a fair probability that a crime, that will turn up evidence of a crime. Now, if they had said, let me give you an example of something that I believe would have passed muster in the warrant application. If the officers had said, we have information from an informant, and the informant was with people, and the informant says that they went with the people to a culvert, and they watched these other people deposit the body there, and those people are so-and-so and so-and-so, and they named them. And here are their phone numbers. Then under that situation, that is sufficiently particular and probable cause would exist because we know it is particularized to those people. We know that the times exist, that they say the informant tells them we were there on such and such date. It was around 8 p.m. That is sufficiently particular. But when you allow officers who are supposed to investigate and do things ahead of time and then use a warrant as a capstone to their investigation. When you allow them to brush aside that investigatory duty and then just decide, you know, I'm going to let Google tell me things and drive my investigation without doing any legwork ahead of time, that's where we get into a constitutional bind.
Counsel, there are cases where geofence warrants have been issued without that type of precise information that you're suggesting is necessary. Would you agree with that?
I would disagree with that, Your Honor. I think the cases that have upheld geofence warrants have been are distinguishable from this case because they are much more particular and specific. They have a much smaller square footage area. They have a much smaller time window of time that they're asking for. They know
so
suspects.
In the United States versus Ryan.
Yes.
In
so
that one, did they have phone numbers for every
each
individual person that the geofence warrant
so this,
covered?
This I'm sorry to interrupt you. In Ryan,
for all 5,000 people that were initially identified.
The geofence warrant
5,000 plus
for
say.
That particular case was particularized to Mr. Ryan, though, and they knew his number ahead of time because they had gotten a tip from someone. It was a text message he had sent someone bragging about being at the Capitol. So that person provided it to the FBI, and from Ryan, it wasn't to catch all of the rioters inside. It was to identify that, yes, he was inside. They knew what he was up to ahead of time. They had the information. They did their investigation ahead of time. They confirmed it in Ryan with the geofence warrant. That is the opposite of what happened here. Here, they knew nothing. They used a geofence warrant to find somebody, and then that drove their investigation to focus upon Mr. Contreras and his co-defendants.
The particularity requirement of Fourth Amendment, I mean, the Fourth Amendment says no warrant shall issue, but particularly describing the place to be searched. What is the place searched in this case? How would we define that?
That would be the area within the geofence boundary, but also the location data of anyone that comes in and out of that is searched, is gathered as part of the geofence warrant.
I mean, so, I understand the geofence, the terms that were used. It seems like this is a search warrant not for a physical location, not for a physical location that's 300 feet by whatever it was, 1,000 feet, but I think, isn't the place to be searched, a digital hard drive in Google's property somewhere?
It's not because it is Google. It is the people who come in and out of that geofence boundary. If they're carrying cell phones, their cell phone location data is going to be searched, is going to be gathered and taken and searched. So it is the data that is searched. And I would point, Your Honor, to Riley, to Carpenter, to all the cell site location information cases that we have out there that have not had a problem with finding that there was a search that occurred here, regardless of the fact that this is a electronic technological search that occurs.
My next question, I guess, is whether the particularity requirement applies to persons or a person. Looking at the text of the Fourth Amendment, it talks about, I was reading, particularly describing the place to be searched, comma, and the persons or things to be seized, which indicates, I think, maybe that's referring to an arrest warrant. Does the case law that, you know, whatever case law there is about these types of digital searches, whether it's a geofence warrant or something else, does it apply the particularity requirement to individual persons in some way? Is that well established?
Yes, Your Honor. When you look at Chatry, for example, they talk about that warrant not being particular because it gathered so much data from so many different people, many of whom were not, actually the vast majority of them were not involved in this bank robbery that was occurring there, that they were trying to find the bank robber. So Yes, and that must be particularized. That was part of the problem there, was it was not particularized to each person. Again, no probable cause to each person as well.
But was that a lack of particularity about place or a lack of particularity about persons?
I believe it was as to both. That warrant failed for multiple reasons, one of them being probable cause, because there was not probable cause to believe that everyone within this geofence warrant, a boundary, was involved in the crime. There was also that boundary could have been shortened, so it was not particular because it was not narrowly tailored. What we're looking here at is narrowly tailored. Can you narrowly tailor this to catch people and not the people who you should catch and not catch up the people who are innocent and should not have their privacy rights violated for police purposes? And here...
Is a person's privacy right violated if the data remains anonymous?
Yes, Your Honor. It's not really...
Is it violated?
Again, I'm going to bring you back to... Maybe I'm going to sound like a broken record here, but I'm going to bring you back to the language of the warrant itself. The anonymous nature of the data is sort of like a distraction or a red herring here. It doesn't matter whether it's anonymous or not. What matters is that data was taken and everyone has a reasonable expectation of privacy with their own cell site location data.
How is that expectation violated where the police don't know what device is attached to an anonymous number?
Well, it doesn't matter because as when you read through Carpenter, I see my time is up. May I respond to your question?
Yes, you may.
When you read through Carpenter, for example, they go through a painstaking analysis of the reasonable expectation of privacy. And that analysis brings us back to the point that anonymous or not, it is your expectation of privacy that rules the day. So your data is protected, but whether they take it and they know who it is or not. It doesn't turn on that.
Sorry. The Constitution protects against unreasonable searches. So if the data remains anonymous, how does the search become unreasonable?
It's unreasonable when it's taken because everyone has a reasonable expectation of privacy in their data, whether the police know it is you by name or not. Your Honors, I see my time has expired. I will be back on rebuttal then. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Workman. Counsel for respondent, please identify yourself and your client, and then you may present your argument.
May it please the court, counsel. I am Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Adam Petrus, and I represent the respondent in this matter, the state of Minnesota. This morning, I'd like to make two main points, and then I'm happy to address any questions that this panel has for me. First, step one and step two of the Google process, if I can call it that, were not actions that are subject to Fourth Amendment protection. I understand that Minnesota Statute Section 626.42, Subdivision 2, requires a, quote, tracking warrant, end quote, in order for law enforcement to obtain the location information of an electronic device. But that statutory requirement of a tracking warrant is not the same as Fourth Amendment protection and all of the Supreme Court case law that appellant cites that applies the Fourth Amendment in other contexts. To be clear, a specific person, of course, has a Fourth Amendment right to be free from unreasonable searches. But a cell phone or another device, which is not a living person, which is a non-living item, does not have a Fourth Amendment right or any constitutional rights for that matter. Thus, anonymized data about a cell phone that does not connect that cell phone with any identifiable person is simply not protected under the plain language of the Fourth Amendment or of the Minnesota constitutional provision that has identical language. I would encourage this court, if it's inclined to issue a precedential decision, to make that the first syllabus point. That is, that gathering anonymous data that is not connected with an identifiable person, like in the first two steps of the Google process, does not implicate the Fourth Amendment or similar Minnesota constitutional provision.
Again, to be clear, are you saying the district court was incorrect on that that point, that step of the analysis?
I don't think the district court specifically, well, actually,
I guess, and maybe I have a two-part question. One is that, do you think that the district court used incorrect reasoning with respect to the Fourth Amendment, or, and in any event, how does this, is this an issue that we must decide in order to resolve this appeal?
I don't think you need to address the specific issue to affirm the district court's decision, which would be resolving the appeal. I do recall a line in the district court order that I'm not able to pull up at the present moment that says something along the lines of basically that language that I cited from section 626.42 referring to a warrant, just kind of assuming we're dealing with a warrant, we have to have the principles of the Fourth Amendment of breadth, particularity, probable cause applied, and then goes through and applies them. I would disagree with that and refer you back to what I was just explaining, that the Fourth Amendment, those protections do not apply to the first two steps. They clearly apply to the third step, and the state's position is that that third step would be a Fourth Amendment search because of the identifying information that ties the device that is the subject of that second search warrant, the search warrant that was applied for and obtained on May 25th, 2021. That obviously resulted in the identifying information that eventually led to appellant. So did I answer your question, Judge Johnson?
I think so. Thank you.
Okay.
So with regard to the initial warrant, it did cover steps 1, 2, and 3.
The warrant itself did, but, I mean, as you were just asking opposing counsel, Judge Cochran, the affidavit or the application, as it's titled, specifically said in pretty plain language that there was going to be a separate additional warrant for the device ID and any identifying information for that device ID. Honestly, it's inconsistent between what's said in the application and what's said in the warrant. Baldock, which you are familiar with because you referenced it before, and that incorporation doctrine remains controlling good law.
But isn't Baldock really distinguishable from this case? Because in Baldock, there, if I'm remembering correctly, the warrant didn't specify the items that were to be seized, and they were arguing that the application should be incorporated by reference, basically. But I think the court found that because it wasn't attached to the warrant, that that the warrant was not. Sorry, I think I have it up on my computer. That in this case, however. The standard wasn't met because the affidavit wasn't attached to the warrant. So, and it basically was trying to specify what wasn't specified in the warrant through the affidavit. But here, what you're arguing is that we should basically read out a provision of the warrant based on the affidavit, which seems to me to be different than what Baldock, the situation that Baldock is addressing.
I will admit that you are more familiar with the factual circumstances in Baldock than I am at right now. The way I read the reference to the brief that the state submitted, referencing Baldock on page 23, is more generally to the as an example of the incorporation doctrine, or and we can reference things when the affidavit or application are attached to search warrant as specifically saying this is exactly what happened in that particular case. I would be happy after the oral argument to try to find an example of where there's a conflict, if you will, between the application and the search warrant and a situation where then they incorporated the rather precise direction from the application is overriding that error that was in the search warrant. And I think practically speaking,
obviously, that search warrant did not lead to any identifying information. It did not lead to anything because there was that second separate search warrant, the one that happened in May as opposed to the one that happened in April.
Is there any information in the record to suggest that the application was attached to the warrant that was sent to Google?
I cannot point you to a site in the 127-page evidentiary hearing right now that says it was. I have always assumed it was, and I don't believe there's been an argument to the contrary made in any of the briefing to this court. But I can't provide a record citation for that. I will say that I believe it's Exhibit 13 from the omnibus of the suppression hearing is that April 29th, 2021 application and search warrant. Those are both included in the addendum to appellant's brief. Exhibit 14 from that suppression hearing is the May 25th, 2021 application and search warrant, and merely the fact that they were included together as a single exhibit at the suppression hearing could suggest that they were actually attached to each other, but I can't say that with certainty that it says that in the record.
Okay, thank you.
In the warrant, the time period is long. Can you address that aspect and why you think that isn't too broad?
Yes, and that actually brings me to the second point I was hoping to get to.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Thank you. And that's because of the particular unique circumstances that we are dealing with here. I heard opposing counsel, and I'm going to paraphrase, and I apologize if it doesn't get exact, say something along the lines of none of those six federal district court decisions, or more than that actually, that address geofence warrants in some way, have approved of a warrant in this precise situation. I mean, the opposite is also true, that none of those have said that a geofence warrant was improper, unconstitutional in a situation like this. And that's because we have to look, and that's what the Fourth Amendment requires, is like drilling down into the specific factual circumstances and the particulars involved in a case. We had an incredibly remote area that this maimed, brutally murdered body was found. There was no inhabitants in this area. It was a culvert under in a place where there's no other residents, no other people. And the information that law enforcement had gathered that is included in both of the warrant applications, both the first one and the second one, from an informant, is that multiple people were involved in assaulting and murdering the victim, and then multiple people were involved in moving the victim's dead body on or about March 28th, in late March 2021. There was not like the precise time, just to contrast it, say, with, say, James, which is a cell tower dump case. But then you had 90-minute windows, then when you could identify when robberies are happening because, the robbery was caught on surveillance video. The surveillance video in those cases just wasn't good enough to identify a suspect.
Couldn't the time of death been more precisely drawn here?
Could the time of death?
Time of death been more precisely indicated?
I'm no forensic expert here, but in terms of the pathology, I believe that they could not even determine the specific cause of death because of the amount of decomposition of the victim's body at the time that it was found. Again, don't quote me on this, but I want to say it was about the last week of April of 2021. So I would gently push back in saying that it was not exactly clear how the victim was killed and thus exactly when they were killed. Again, we were operating with that limited information from the informant, who was not an anonymous informant, someone who's known and identified by initials to law enforcement, but to protect that individual, they're not necessarily flat out named in the search warrant affidavit or the search warrant itself. But
that informant did indicate to the police that the perpetrators may have had cell phones. Is that accurate?
That is also specifically included. And there's also case law, going back to James, the Eighth Circuit case I mentioned before that's cited in the briefing, in which it was actually Judge Strauss, who wrote that decision, talking about, that judges don't need to check their common sense at the door, and that people in now in present day society are always carrying cell phones. But in this particular case, Judge Smith, you're exactly right that there was information from that informant that was included in the application for the search warrant that the assailants, that the perpetrators here, did have cell phones on them. I mean, and when they were carrying this out. And I mean,
can
if this.
Can you address, I know your time is limited here, could you address appellant's argument that in order to pass constitutional muster, a geofence warrant would need to identify the individuals and their phone numbers?
I don't see any requirement for that in controlling law. I understand that in an ideal world, law enforcement has a lot more information that it's able to obtain or is provided to it. But in terms of having a phone number itself, I mean, that just jumps right to the third step. I mean, if
well, or that the application would have to say, right, yeah, that's true.
But what
case would you point us to that you think is most comparable to this situation? I know each case is distinguishable on its facts, but in terms of the type of warrant application that was made here and the amount of information that the officer had in the affidavit?
I don't think it's actually identical or even strikingly similar to any of the six federal district court decisions that you have before. I'm going back to the point I was trying to make to Judge Smith in response to his question, is that you just had very different factual circumstances here. And that's what a Fourth Amendment analysis is looking at the particular facts and circumstances that are present in any investigation. If you had this geofence area, which is about the size, I think of it as a third of a football field, and you plop that down in urban St. Paul, in urban Minneapolis, that could be unreasonable if it was to include any individual residents.
I didn't ask the question very well, but in terms of a showing of probable cause, you know, the amount of information that the officer had in the application was that there was a body that had been found there, that there was clearly a crime, and that there was information from an informant that had talked to someone, I believe, that said that they knew the people that had placed the body and that they had cell phones. And maybe I don't have that exactly right in terms of how it was phrased in the application, but, you know, why is that sufficient to find probable cause to issue the geofence warrant?
Because it's probable cause that a crime was committed, and probable cause that the devices that were present in the area where the crime was committed, because, I mean, we had a culvert in a remote area, and we're looking for specifically a device that was present for more than just passing past that one road that was included in the geofence area. I sense a follow-up question.
No? Well, but I think, you know, appellant would argue that there isn't any information to show that the phones had a Google app on them or the extent to which Google is used by phone users generally. There was just kind of general information that these individuals may have, you know, had cell phones. And how is that sufficient to demonstrate that the location information could be evidence, that there was reason to believe that there's location information that could be evidence of a crime, or there's fair probability of that?
Judge Johnson, I see my time's expired. May I take a moment to respond to
yes,
Judge Cochran's question?
Yes, please. You can fully answer the question.
Thank you. Judge Cochran, I felt a couple parts of that. I want to tackle the one I'm thinking of right now, which is the lack of information in the search warrant application about was there a Google application of some sort present on these particular cell phones. And I think time and again, the body of law that has addressed geofence warrants specifically, again, the 6 to 10 cases that are repeatedly cited in the briefing, it's really well established in that body of law about how common Google applications are on cell phones, and how that technology works to determine the location of a phone at a given time. That was not something in my reading of the evidentiary hearing or any of the litigation in the district court that was ever disputed in some way. And Judge Garcia, in her order, I think it was even included in the findings section, kind of just, you know, commented about the reality that Google-connected cell phones are incredibly common in society. Judge Strauss said the same thing in James, that Eighth Circuit decision I keep referring back to. And so in terms of that particular detail not being spelled out in the search warrant application, I don't think that's absolutely necessary. Again, no member of the judiciary needs to check their common sense at the door if, you know, the idea of if there's information that the assailant or people who are depositing the body in this remote location had cell phones on them, that in itself is enough. I mean, past the fact that any development of the record about what Google does, that would have probably actually happened at an evidentiary hearing, which would have been after the search warrant. At least it was in those, in those federal district court cases. In terms of whether or not there was probable cause, I would return to my original argument. I sense that you were asking that question to be like, you know, maybe we don't need to decide whether the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply to those first two steps. I really don't think it does. And if you look into just the language of 626.42 subdivision 2, and which is what requires the tracking warrant, each of those requirements is satisfied based on the information in this application warrant. And there's even a provision, I don't have the exact clause site at the top of my head, but it says that even if the actual suspect, or even if like the individual is unknown, those tracking warrants contemplate that there is no identifying information or there is no known suspect, and that search warrants or a tracking warrant in this particular case can be an investigative tool at the front end in an investigation as opposed to just a capstone at the end when an individual has been known. I'm sure I abused Judge Johnson's invitation to fully answer the question, so I will stop there. I will ask this court to affirm. I will happily entertain any other questions, but I realize what time it is as well.
It appears there are no further questions. Thank you, Mr. Petras. Ms. Workman, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Your Honors, there are a couple of factual misstatements by counsel that I want to correct for the record. First, counsel said that there are no inhabitants in this area. That's incorrect. And I don't mean to disparage counsel for that. He just subbed into this case, so he's probably not aware of all of the facts. There were houses in this area. In fact, the Wi-Fi signal for one of the houses was caught up in the data that was collected as part of this geofence warrant. Regarding whether the commonality...
They were not in the perimeters of the geofence,
they were not,
right?
But the public road to their homes was. Yeah. The commonality, whether commonality was disputed, it absolutely was disputed below. And the dispute was whether there needs to be more of a record of, and that's because the other cases, all of the federal cases, have a very robust record to work with as to how Google tracks people, how they collect the data. The police officers in those cases testified for days about how all of that worked. We have none of that here. We have no information about how Google collects their data. We have no information about, in the application itself, as to whether these cell phones that they may have had were even Google-connected cell phones. We don't have their phone numbers. We have nothing. So that distinguishes this case from the other cases where the courts had much more information to work with.
Do you believe the district court made factual findings that are not based on the evidence in this record?
As far as I can recall, Your Honor, I don't believe that is something that is in dispute here. Your Honor,
and the reason I ask is because the district court, I think, in making findings of fact or discussing factual issues, the district court cited some case law for its descriptions of Google's processes.
Right, but that was not a factual finding. That was more of just a statement of...
Not a disputed fact, perhaps, or not...
Right, in other cases, they have found that, yes, they are common. Yes, they are common, but we don't know how they worked in this case, and you must have more before you to say that this is good information for them to rely upon to get a warrant, and we don't have that here. Your Honors, as far as whether there was a search, and this sort of just goes to the preliminary questions here, that was waived by the state below. The state never argued that there was no search that occurred here, and therefore the judge should just stop and not even get into the rest of the analysis. The district court impliedly found that there was a search because the district court carried on with the analysis through to the very end. And I would say if there's any question as to whether there was a search here, that has been waived. Your Honor should not concern yourselves with that.
Did you make that argument in your brief?
I did, Your Honor. Yes, okay. in the reply brief, yes,
Your
Honor.
In the reply brief. Okay, yes. Thank you.
And, Your
Can
Honor.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, Your Honor.
If we would, do you agree with the state's view that if step three was to be found to be overly broad, that part of the warrant could be severed to cure the unconstitutional concern with that part of the warrant?
No, Your Honor, I don't agree with severance at all. As severance rises and falls with whether it is completely independent and can itself support its own warrant. The step three here could not have happened without step one and step two. It completely depends upon what they find out in step one and two. That's why I've said this entire time that they rise and they fall together, and that those are interconnected. You cannot separate them from each other. Your Honors, I would also just point you to, regarding particularity, I would point you to Groh versus Ramirez, which is a United States Supreme Court case. I can get you a citation here for just a second. 540 U.S. 551, that is a particularity in a warrant case. And there, that warrant failed to describe the objects or the people to be seized, and it gave too much discretion to law enforcement and was invalid on its face. So, Your Honors, I would just ask you to look that case over for the particularity points and see what it is that we hold our law enforcement to when it comes to writing a particular warrant that passes constitutional muster. I see that my time has expired. Are there any other questions from the court?
It appears not.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Workman. Thank you to both attorneys for your excellent arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days.